We all know that over the past 12 months, the price of a gallon of gas has risen over a dollar from around $3 last year to over $4 today. And diesel has increased from $2.91 a year ago to $4.72 per gallon today. At the listening sessions that I hold in every county of my state each year, Wisconsinites are, of course, talking about how those soaring oil prices are hurting their pocketbooks. And it's not just at the pump. They are feeling the pain also at the grocery store, on the farm, and at the ticket counter. Those high fuel prices are having a rippling effect throughout our entire economy. Wisconsinites, like Americans all around the country, are feeling squeezed, and with no relief in sight, the anxiety and tension keep building. Americans are emotionally, physically, and financially drained. My colleague from Minnesota, Senator Klobuchar, had it right when she stated that Americans are running on empty. And here is what I'm hearing from Wisconsinites. One constituent told me, "I have done everything I can to use as little gas as possible, even before prices got so high. My two-parent family with two children has only one car. I ride my bicycle or walk to work and use the car as little as possible. However, the rising cost of fuel is causing higher prices for food and other necessities, which are becoming more difficult for my family and others," unquote. And from another parent, "I have an adorable child I'm trying to raise on a budget that no longer reaches from paycheck to paycheck. I currently work an hour away from where I live as the jobs are not available in my area. Between the rising price of gas, electric heat, and food, my husband and I can barely pay our mortgage." And I've heard from many others who are struggling as they care for elderly parents. One lady has a mother in a nursing home, and she used to visit her three times a week. However, with the nursing home 20 miles away and high fuel prices, now she can only afford to visit her mother once a week. That's, to me, a very poignant example of one of so many examples of the real human impact that these gas prices have. Even those who have managed their money well and have saved are struggling. One constituent commented that he had planned to put extra money towards retirement, pay down debt. With the high fuel prices, he doesn't have any extra money and is worried that he will end up on government assistance at the age of 57. There are more letters and more emails and more phone calls. The high cost of driving affects all kinds of people and livelihoods. It affects kids whose parents cannot drive them across town to a friend's house or to soccer practice because they have to conserve gas to get to work. It affects young students and senior citizens who are on fixed incomes. Small businesses are finding they need to increase prices to cover increased transportation costs. Farmers are, of course, feeling the pinch. Oil prices impact almost every one of their production costs in one way or another, whether it be fertilizer or fuel or transportation or feed for livestock and dairy farmers. All over the country, people have resorted to alternative forms of transportation in an effort to escape these costs. There are a range of positive proposals to improve systems in Wisconsin, from the Kenosha Racine Milwaukee commuter rail, extending Amtrak to Madison, or just adding buses or routes. Now, while I strongly support long-term plans to invest in mass transit, I also recognize that at least for the time being in many parts of Wisconsin and in this country, it is unrealistic for many people to really rely on mass transportation. Commuting to work, be it across a large city or between two towns, is a gas and dollar-guzzling task that many people cannot avoid or increasingly afford. The large number of Americans living in predominantly rural areas is especially challenging due to the typically longer trips and fewer transportation options. So Wisconsinites want to know, when is the federal government going to provide some relief? Now, with my support, Congress has made some progress. Last December, we enacted energy legislation, H.R. 6, that raises corporate average fuel economy standards for vehicles while protecting American jobs, and also increases the requirement for alternative fuels from 8.5 billion gallons in 2008 to 36 billion gallons in 2022. I also recently co-sponsored an amendment to make the federal government stop filling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is 97% full. Fortunately, Congress passed this legislation, and the administration finally agreed to stop taking oil off the market to store it underground. The bill, H.R. 6022, was signed into law in May. We also made, Mr. President, some progress in preventing market manipulation. I co-sponsored the Oil and Gas Traders Oversight Act, S-577, which would help ensure that the previously unregulated trading of energy commodities is subject to greater federal oversight by requiring the reporting of trades. And then a similar provision was included in the final version of the Farm Bill, which was recently enacted. These are, Mr. President, positive steps. But much more needs to be done. So today, I'm introducing legislation that seeks to answer a question more and more Americans are asking, which is, why aren't the oil companies developing 66 million acres of land that they're already leasing from the U.S. government? Those same companies and some of my colleagues say that we need to open more federal lands to drilling. Well, I guess I'd like to know then why the oil companies are not producing on most of the federal lands that they already have under a lease. At a recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, I actually had the chance to ask the top five oil executives in the country just that question. And it was incredible, Mr. President. They really couldn't come up with any good explanation at all. In fact, one of the executives told me that they have the manpower and the infrastructure to put all of their existing leases of federal lands into oil production. I find this troubling. No one is talking about pulling oil out of a hat. But with 75% of currently leased federal lands and waters not producing oil and gas, Congress needs to insist on some accountability on this point. And this is why today I'm introducing the Responsible Federal Oil and Gas Lease Act. This bill says, Mr. President, if oil and gas companies want to lease additional federal lands, they must either be producing or diligently developing their existing federal leases, or they have to give up those leases. This way, if a company makes the business decision to terminate or not pursue exploration, then the lease will be made available to other companies who might actually drill or figure out a way to get some oil out of these lands. This is a responsible way to increase production and also keep the private sector accountable for production. So with over 100 billion barrels of oil under federal lands and waters that are being leased or are available for leasing, Congress must properly encourage their development. An oil company should use the land they already have before coming to Congress hat in hand asking for more land. This bill is similar to legislation introduced by Representative Rahal, which the House considered last month. I'll work to make sure that the Senate follows their lead. I'm also co-sponsoring a bill introduced by my colleague who's on the floor, my good friend Senator Dodd, that encourages oil companies to utilize the land they've been granted by making them pay fees on land under lease but not in production. There are a number of other steps Congress should take, including addressing the role of excess speculation in the energy futures market and clamping down on OPEC's price fixing. I am a co-sponsor of S-879, which would authorize the Justice Department and the FTC to sue foreign countries under U.S. antitrust law for limiting the supply or fixing the price of oil. And, of course, we need to aggressively pursue alternative fuels, efficiency, and renewable energy. Because the facts show that even if we drilled every corner of the country, and offshore too, that wouldn't solve our energy problems. In the long term, the government's Energy Information Administration reports that opening more outer continental shelf regions to drilling, quote, would not have a significant impact on domestic crude oil and natural gas production or prices before 2030, unquote. Nor will it significantly affect prices after 2030, the agency reports, quote, because oil prices are determined on the international market, unquote. In short, the facts are telling us that we simply cannot just drill our way out of this one, and more drilling does not necessarily mean lower prices at the pump. Unfortunately, a minority of senators have repeatedly blocked efforts to expand renewables and address price gouging and excess energy market speculation. I sincerely hope that we can get beyond this partisan bickering. My constituents don't want finger-pointing or name-calling. They want some relief, and they deserve it. And they also deserve to know that we are pressing forward on plans that embrace a new energy future. 30 years ago, our nation was rattled by our reliance on oil. If I'm still here in 30 years, for the sake of my constituents, I hope that we will have succeeded at diversifying our energy uses in oil and does not still have a stranglehold over the lives of our citizens and the economy. Mr. President, I yield the floor.